Ever wondered how, like, one company polluting could end up causing a whole legal mess affecting all sorts of people and businesses?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Today, we're going deep into this case, Pruitt v. Allied Chemical Corp. It's from 1981.
Go.
It's really important for understanding class actions in environmental law and how courts deal with the economic damage from pollution.
Yeah, when you've got contamination that's not just hurting people's health or property, but like a whole region's economy.
Exact.
Pruitt is a great case to see how complicated it gets. This deep dive should be really insightful for law students, especially.
And this all started with Allied Chemical, right? They discharged Capone into the James River, which flows into the Chesapeake Bay. What's fascinating is it wasn't just the fishermen who sued.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, you had the fishermen and the crabbers for sure, but then also marinas, tackle shops, places selling bait, even wholesalers and restaurants further down the line. All saying they were hurt because the bay was polluted. And get this, the court had to make some tough calls about who actually had the right to be compensated.
That's what we're going to break down today. So our mission is to figure out who actually has the legal standing to sue when a shared resource like a bay or a river gets polluted, especially when the main harm is economic, not just, someone getting sick or their property being damaged. And on top of that, how did the court even handle so many different people and businesses all as one big class action? So first things first, what even was this Capone situation?
Okay, so Allied Chemical was making Capone, which was a pesticide, and somehow a lot of it got discharged, like released into the James River,
Oh
which, as you said,
no.
goes right into the Chesapeake Bay. This really messed up the marine environment, leading to bans on fishing. People got really worried about whether the seafood was even safe to eat.
Yeah, I bet. That's when those economic ripples start, right? It's not just the environment itself, it's people's jobs, their whole way of life.
Yeah, it's exactly.
So who were these plaintiffs, the people who sued? I think there were 29 of them initially.
Yeah, 29 named plaintiffs, and there were all sorts. People directly harvesting seafood, businesses connected to the bay in some way. The class they were trying to represent was huge, covering residents of both Virginia and Maryland, whose livelihoods depended on the seafood industry in those affected waters. There were a few exceptions because of a related case that happened early.
Oh, wow. That's a lot to manage.
Yeah.
What were their legal arguments? What were they claiming Allied Chemical did wrong?
They had several claims. One was nuisance, arguing that Allied Chemical was interfering with their right to use and enjoy public property, basically making the bay unusable for its intended purposes. They also claimed negligence. That means they had to prove that Allied Chemical had a duty to be careful, that they breached that duty, and that this breach caused their economic losses. And sometimes in environmental cases, you can even see claims of strict liability.
Strict liability.
Yeah, that's where fault doesn't really matter. If the activity is inherently dangerous, you can be liable for any harm that results, regardless of whether you were negligent or not.
Interesting. It sounds like the legal side of this is already complicated, and then you add in the whole jurisdiction question too. Like,
Right.
what court even has the authority to hear this case? I see we have diversity jurisdiction, federal question jurisdiction, and admiralty jurisdiction. How did admiralty law get pulled into this? That's like something straight out of a law school exam.
Yeah, it's a good one. So the connection to admiralty law is because the pollution happened in navigable waters, the James River and the Chesapeake Bay. And those are traditionally under federal admiralty jurisdiction. Plus, commercial fishing. That's a maritime activity by nature. So the economic harm to those involved is tied to maritime commerce enough to potentially trigger admiralty jurisdiction.
I see.
Diversity jurisdiction was likely there because the plaintiffs and Allied Chemical were from different states. And they might have argued federal question jurisdiction if there was a specific federal environmental law involved. This combo of jurisdictional grounds is pretty unique and shows how complex things get.
Okay, so we've got this major pollution, a ton of people claiming economic harm, and a tangled web of jurisdiction. Let's get to the heart of the legal issue, the doctrine of economic harm. Like, what do courts usually say about purely economic losses? Money damages, but no one's physically hurt, no property's been directly damaged.
So, tort law is usually cautious about letting people recover for purely economic loss. Yeah,
Cautious.
there's this idea that if your harm is only financial, stemming from damage to someone else's property, you usually can't get compensated. This is tied to the Barbara Lyons doctrine.
Barbara Lyons.
It essentially says if a third party's property is damaged and you lose money because of that, but your own property is fine, well, tough luck. the courts worry about unlimited liability.
Right, that makes sense.
If one careless act could mean paying everyone even remotely affected, it'd be chaos, right? Courts would be overloaded and businesses wouldn't know what hit them.
The classic opening the floodgates argument.
Exactly. But Pruitt, now this is where it gets interesting. Pruitt kind of found a way around this.
Oh, tell me about this constructive property interest thing.
This is key. See, the court said some plaintiffs, even though they didn't own the fish in the bay or the water itself,
right,
they depended on those resources so much for their livelihood that it's like they did have a property interest.
The constructive one.
Yeah, the court basically said, look, you might not own the fish legally, but your whole life is tied to them, to the bay being healthy. So for this case, we're going to treat it like you have a property right. This let them separate the people whose income was directly, obviously, tied to the bay's productivity from those who were more indirectly affected. It's a big deal because they moved beyond strict ownership. They said strong economic dependence is enough to have standing to be able to sue.
Okay, so who fit into that intimate connection group and who was left out? This is where those lines got drawn, right?
Exactly. Marina owners, people owning boat, tackle, bait shops.
Yeah.
They got to proceed with their claims. The reasoning was, those businesses directly serve the folks fishing in the bay, commercially or recreationally. If fishing stops because of pollution, those businesses tank immediately. Their success is totally linked to the bay being fishable.
That makes sense. It's like their businesses are practically part of the fishing industry itself.
Right. But then seafood wholesalers, retailers, processors, restaurants.
Yeah.
They got dismissed. The court said their harm, while real, was too far down the line.
Too many steps removed from the actual pollution.
Yeah. Their businesses depend on other stuff, market trends, you know, more variables. It makes that direct link to the harm less clear. They buy and sell seafood, sure, but they're not as directly involved in the act of fishing as, say, a marina.
So the court's trying to find this balance. Where do we draw the line?
Absolutely. They were wrestling with this. You got to compensate for predictable harm, but also avoid this avalanche of lawsuits. They admitted that restaurants and wholesalers getting hurt was foreseeable, but they were scared that letting those more indirect claims through would mean unlimited liability for Allied Chemical. Like the economic ripples could go on forever.
Yeah, it could affect the whole region.
Right. They also looked at how connected each business was to the resource that got damaged, the bay, and the social value of those businesses. It wasn't just about whether the harm was predictable. It was also about managing how far the liability could reach.
Okay, so we've covered who can sue for economic harm. Now, how did they handle all these potential plaintiffs in a class action? They were proposing this massive class. What did they do under Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure?
So Rule 23 has all these requirements for certifying a class action. One is numerosity. Meaning there are so many potential plaintiffs that individual lawsuits would be a nightmare. You need commonality too. Shared legal and factual questions that apply to everyone in the class. Typicality means the named plaintiff's claims have to represent the whole group. And adequacy of representation ensures the plaintiffs and their lawyers can actually protect everyone's interests fairly.
Right.
For a class action about money damages like this one, a Rule 23-3 class, the court also needs to see that the common questions are more important than individual issues, and that a class action is the best, most efficient way to resolve everything fairly.
So with all these different plaintiffs, from fishermen directly hit to restaurants maybe steps removed,
yeah,
finding those common issues and proving a class action is the best way to go. That had to be tough. That's where subclasses come in, right?
Exactly. The court saw that each person's situation, their economic losses, could be very different.
There.
So they did something clever. They made six separate subclasses within the bigger group. Yep. This is a huge procedural lesson. When you've got complex litigation, breaking a big class into smaller, more similar groups is essential.
Makes it more manageable.
Right, and fairer. In Pruitt, these subclasses were based on a few things. The type of economic harm, like were they directly harvesting or processing seafood? The geography, were they in Virginia or Maryland? Because state laws could differ. And even the legal arguments they were making, like nuisance versus negligence.
Six subclasses, that's a lot of dividing and conquering.
It was all about grouping plaintiffs whose claims shared similar facts and legal issues. So you've got all the commercial fishermen in Virginia working on the James River.
Yeah.
They'd likely have very similar stories about how the fishing bans hurt their catches and income. Separating them from, let's say, Maryland restaurant owners makes the litigation smoother.
Because those restaurant owners might be dealing with different market forces, different state laws about business losses.
Exactly. Within each subclass, those common questions would be more likely to outweigh individual issues.
It's like organizing a giant puzzle.
Yeah, kind of.
I also see the court chose to bifurcate the trial. What does that mean in this context?
Bifurcation just means splitting the trial into two stages.
Two stages.
Yeah. So in Pruitt, they decided to first have a trial just on liability. This meant figuring out, was Allied Chemical negligent in releasing the Capone? And did that actually harm the James River and Chesapeake Bay?
Okay.
If the plaintiffs won on those big common questions, then they'd have a second trial to figure out the individual damages for each person in each subclass. This is a super common, efficient tactic in class actions.
Makes sense, instead of trying to calculate everyone's individual losses all at once right out of the gate.
Right, figure out who's responsible, and if there was harm, then dive into the specifics.
So looking back, what are the big takeaways from Pruitt in terms of procedure? Things that would be important for future courts dealing with big environmental class actions.
Pruitt laid out a sort of blueprint.
A blueprint.
Yeah, they stress that courts have to really scrutinize those individual issues, especially around foreseeability and causation of each plaintiff's specific economic loss.
Meaning, was the harm predictable and was it actually caused by the defendant's actions?
Yeah, and do those individual issues overshadow the common questions that hold the class or a subclass together? They also highlighted how important it is to consider whether subclasses can help those common questions take center stage.
Right.
And ultimately, the court has to decide if a class action, even with subclasses and splitting the trial, is truly better than making thousands of people file their own lawsuits.
And it seems like Pruitt has really shaped how these mass environmental lawsuits are handled even today, right? You mentioned Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah, though the specifics of Deepwater Horizon are a whole other story.
Of course.
But it shows how the principles and tools from Pruitt are still relevant.
Mm-hmm.
In Deepwater Horizon, you also had a huge environmental disaster messing with tons of economic interests. And the courts had to, again, define the limits of economic harm, manage this gigantic class action with all sorts of claimants. They used subclasses and other procedures to keep things fair and efficient. Pruitt really set a precedent.
But that constructive property interest idea, some people might say that was pushing the boundaries of traditional tort law, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and there's been debate about it ever since.
Debate.
Yeah, some argue that expanding the idea of what counts as a property interest was necessary.
Necessary because
It gave a legal way to address serious, predictable economic harm directly from pollution. Even if those harm didn't technically own the polluted thing. Others say the court went too far, that making up new legal concepts creates uncertainty.
So it's this tension between adapting the law to new problems and sticking to tradition.
Exactly.
It's interesting to think that maybe the limits of traditional law, like we see in Pruitt, are part of why we now have modern environmental regulations, like CERCLE, the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act.
Oh, absolutely. Cases like Pruitt showed how hard it was to rely only on old tort law, which focuses on individual harm and property rights.
Yeah.
It just wasn't enough to deal with environmental damage that's so widespread.
Right.
That's why we needed broader laws like CERCLE. It gives a better system for dealing with hazardous waste sites, figuring out who's responsible for cleanup, addressing all kinds of environmental harms.
So for our listeners who are law students out there grappling with torts, environmental laws, civil procedure, what are the absolute must-know points from Pruitt v. Allied Chemical, things that will help them in school and in their future careers?
Okay, a few things. Procedure is king. Pruitt shows how class certification isn't just yes or no. Subclassing is a powerful tool.
Subclassing.
Yeah, dividing the class up. It helps manage these crazy, complex cases, lets them move forward in a way that wouldn't be possible otherwise. Pruitt, with its six subclasses, based on the type of harm, location, and legal claims, it's a perfect example of Rule 23 in action.
What about economic harm itself? That seems to be a tricky area in environmental law.
Oh, for sure. Pruitt highlights how tricky it is to get compensation for purely economic losses. Courts are always struggling with this question. How directly connected does the harm have to be to let someone recover money when they haven't been physically hurt or their property damaged? Comparing Pruitt's constructive property interest with cases like Robin's Dry Dock, where you usually can't recover for economic loss due to damage to someone else's property you rely on, That's key for understanding tort law and environmental litigation.
So, future environmental lawyers, imagine you're on your 1L or 2L exam. You get a hypothetical about environmental damage. Lots of different businesses and people have lost money.
Step one, separate physical harm from purely economic loss.
Right.
Then look closely. Do any potential plaintiffs have that close connection to the harmed resource, like in Pruitt, to maybe fit that constructive property interest exception? And think about the procedural challenges of a class action. How can you use subclasses to structure the case based on the types of harm and legal claims?
And remember, the court in Pruitt was worried about opening the floodgates to too many lawsuits.
Right.
So how do you think courts today are balancing the need to compensate victims of environmental harm with the possibility of huge liability for companies? Wow. And how have environmental laws since Pruitt tried to deal with these issues that common law struggled with? Big questions, but super important for anyone interested in law and the environment. Thanks for joining me on this deep dive.